Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It might not be a full-blown crisis just yet, but the mortgage mess does keep on getting messier. More banks are putting the brakes on foreclosure processing. But today, the White House said, no, you guys keep on going. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation Defender, helping doctors, lawyers, and small business owners monitor, protect, and improve their online reputations. ReputationDefender.com. And by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and Progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is Tuesday, the 12th of October, and it is good, as always, to have you here. You know the basic storyline so far, right? About 2 weeks ago, we learned banks have been rushing through their foreclosure paperwork without actually reading it or even making sure they really own the mortgage for the house they're foreclosing on. A number of big banks, Bank of America, Ally Financial among them, have put what is at least a temporary stop to things. It has all attracted the attention of state prosecutors. This week, probably tomorrow, a group of as many as 40 state attorneys general are going to announce an investigation into the mortgage servicing industry. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale explains now that they're going to try to pressure lenders to reconsider some of those foreclosures.
States have been trying to jawbone lenders into helping people keep their homes by maybe extending the length of some mortgages or lowering interest rates or maybe even reducing the principal. That's called marking the home value to the market. So far, none of that's worked. Banks want bad assets off their books, and foreclosing and selling accomplishes that, says economist Jim Gaines at Texas A&M University.
The lenders are right now looking at their books and saying, we're still carrying a lot of bad assets. We really couldn't afford right now to truly mark to market. A lot of us might go insolvent because the banks are still trying to earn their way out of a big hole.
But if an investigation reveals banks have violated state laws with sloppy foreclosure paperwork, they may owe hefty fines. Tom LaMalfa at TSL Consulting thinks the attorneys general see dollar signs.
There is a desire on the part of many states to get money from the banks to help pay the huge cost of the foreclosure crisis on their states and on their municipalities.
And Jim Gaines at Texas A&M says banks may be forced to tell states they'll be more open to renegotiating loans.
They may work some kind of an agreement or settlement to A, mitigate whatever that financial liability might be, and then B, to also allow the process to continue.
Because, he says, delaying foreclosures only postpones the day of reckoning for billions of dollars in bad assets still festering on lenders' books. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs said today his boss is not going to call for a nationwide moratorium on housing foreclosures just yet. The basic theory they have is that that would put quite the hiccup in any recovery the housing market might be able to make. This is one of those stories that's going to be with us for a while, hopefully not as long as the financial crisis, but for a while anyway. So to get some context, we've called Nicholas Ritsinas. He teaches housing finance and real estate at the Harvard Business School. Nick, it's good to have you with us.
Nice to be with you.
There is clearly a volume problem here, right? Hundreds of thousands, millions of foreclosures, stacks of documents. But it does seem that there's something more fundamental, I guess, right?
There is. It's fundamental in that the servicers who are trying to process these foreclosures have just been sloppy. I mean, it's ironic that liar loans got us into this problem, and now sloppy servicing seems to prolong the problem.
Why, then, is the Obama administration against a moratorium on foreclosures? Wouldn't it seem to make sense just to put a pause on everything and figure it all out first?
Well, a number of lenders, investors, and servicers have effectively done that. They're saying, hey, wait a minute, let's just make sure we have the paperwork in place before we proceed. So stopping all foreclosures will just delay the clearing of this pipeline, and as long as we have foreclosures entering the marketplace, the longer the recovery will be.
Yeah, somebody said to me the other day, it's kind of like the pig going through the python. It's just going to take a while.
And at some point, it's got to get through. In the marketplace now, it's not unusual to have a third of all sales be foreclosure sales. And as long as that's taking place, that's going to dampen prices. That's going to make people sit on the sidelines. So we've got to get this through, and this isn't helping.
How badly could it spread, though? I mean, we had the financial crisis, and that spread into the broader economy. Could this then spread even more?
Think so, because in a sense, this is sort of clearing out the problems that led to that implosion and led to the broader crisis. I think, sadly, the more likely scenario is just a prolong of this misery in the housing market and the clearing that needs to take place.
So let's say the president calls you tomorrow and says, Nick, listen, I need your sage counsel. What are the three or four things I can do to make this better?
Well, the bigger thing, and there's a limit to what government can do, is get people back to work. Because in many ways, the problem with the housing market isn't a housing problem anymore. It's an income problem. It's people either have lost their jobs, have fewer hours, or are afraid of losing their jobs. So getting people back to work is really the first, second, and third thing that would try to bring some semblance of normalcy to the housing market. Moving forward with the regulations under the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau makes a lot of sense. This is a reminder of why those kinds of rules are necessary.
Given that we have become aware of how badly the mortgage granting process was messed up in the past 5 to 10 years, should we be at all surprised that on the flip side of this coin, that the resolution of foreclosures is messed up as well?
Not at all. It was sloppy paperwork that was part, not all, but part of the problem that got us into this. The fact that there's sloppy paperwork at the other end is a reminder of how ill-prepared the industry was, and we as regulators were to take on this problem.
Is it at all possible that because we dealt with a financial crisis, we have some grasp of how to deal with what is now a foreclosure and mortgage crisis?
I'm not sure that we do, because the problem keeps changing. There were some opportunities early on in the crisis where the government could have had a more dramatic intervention. For example, bankruptcy reform, which I think could have forced some lenders and investors to the table. But that opportunity has passed. Now the problem is less of a housing problem and more of a problem of the broader economy.
Nick Ritsinas, he teaches real estate at the Harvard Business School. Nick, thanks a lot.
Nice to be with you.
One other moratorium note before we move on. Now, the White House lifted its ban on deepwater oil drilling today, 7 weeks ahead of when it was set to expire. Interior Secretary Ken Salazar said getting new rules in place just went faster than anybody thought. On Wall Street today, started low, ended high. Well, higher, anyway. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The merger news of this Tuesday in October is of the pharmaceutical variety. Pfizer is going to shell out more than $3.5 billion to buy King Pharmaceuticals. King makes painkillers, mostly. And that's exactly what Pfizer is going to need the next couple of years. Some of its biggest blockbusters, including the cholesterol drug Lipitor, are about to lose their patent protection. The deal today is one way to soften the expected hit to Pfizer's revenue. Something else that could be eating into drug company profits? People walking away from the pharmacy without their meds. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
A few months ago, Kristen Van Tiel and her husband went to the pharmacy to pick up his asthma inhaler and got this news. His copay had quadrupled from $10 to $40. He's an accountant. She works in fashion. They couldn't really spare the extra money.
He wasn't wheezing so bad he couldn't breathe, so we decided to pass on it.
The drug industry has a word for this, abandonment. And it's on the rise. Walters Kluwer Pharma Solutions tracks prescription drugs. The company says abandoned prescriptions are up 86% in the second quarter of this year compared to 4 years ago. Jeff Randall practices physical medicine and rehabilitation in Salt Lake City, Utah. He says patients aren't just turning down drugs.
I think with the downturn in the economy, certainly seen an increase in patients worried about every dollar. I prescribe a lot of physical therapy as well, and I've had quite a bit of patients who can't or won't go to therapy because of the copay.
Randall says doctors should consider cost when writing prescriptions, but that can create difficult choices. Randall himself has prescribed a cheaper, short-acting pain medication when patients can't afford one that lasts longer.
When patients feel like they are roller-coastering, when they get a burst of pain relief and then it quickly wanes, there's a chance they'll become more easily addicted to a pain medication.
By saving money now, patients could end up paying for bigger health problems down the road. And researchers say the situation is likely to get worse. As healthcare reform cuts into profits, insurers may pass on more of their costs to patients, leaving more pill bottles abandoned on pharmacy shelves. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
The new thing in the automotive business hasn't even hit the streets yet. The Chevy Volt isn't going to be on sale for at least a couple of months. But we've been hearing about the thing for years, how it's going to be all electric, not one of those part gas plug-in hybrids. But since the Volt's patents were approved last month, auto experts have gotten a better look under the hood, leading to some questions about how electric the Volt really is. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports.
The Volt arrives in dealer showrooms later this year. Tony Posawatz is the lead GM engineer behind it.
With the Chevrolet Volt, you can burn rubber and not petroleum.
Which is not to say the car never burns gasoline. It has a backup gas engine.
This is where the Volt differentiates itself from a typical battery electric car. It offers an additional 300 miles of range, so a Volt can be your everyday car. And so the engine runs to create electricity when the battery state of charge dips below a certain point.
Dan Neal, auto critic for the Wall Street Journal, says GM erred in describing the Volt as completely electric.
General Motors has denied over and over again that it was a plug-in hybrid kind of vehicle. And indeed, it's barely a plug-in hybrid vehicle. But in fact, it works a little bit like a Prius works.
So the Volt relies mostly on electricity and a little bit of gas. So what? Neal says this amounts to bad PR when many are still upset about the auto bailout.
People are looking for a reason to be skeptical or derisive or dismissive of General Motors and the Volt. GM has just handed its critics a stick to hit them with.
What about consumers who want to buy an electric car? Jack Nerad is with Kelley Blue Book.
There's a percentage of the populace out there who is gung-ho about electric vehicles. And if this is operating more like a hybrid and less like a pure electric, that might give them pause.
So far, the federal government hasn't changed its perception of the Volt. As an electric vehicle, it qualifies for a $7,500 federal tax credit. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
For all the diehard bibliophiles say they will never, ever give up their actual printed books, they may in fact be fighting a losing battle. E-book sales are up 118% this year over last. The number comes from the Association of American Publishers. You don't have to buy your e-books, though. Public libraries will let you borrow them for nothing. Not without some fine print, though, as Gigi Duban reports now from Birmingham, Alabama.
How are you today?
I'm good. How are you?
Great. The circulation desk at the downtown branch of the Birmingham Public Library is humming with activity. And long after the library closes for the day, dozens of users will continue to check out books from home. The county's libraries last month launched an e-book collection. Users check out e-books for a couple of weeks by downloading onto a computer or an e-reader. Pat Ryan is director of the county library system.
And there are no late fees, no trip to the library. The book expires after the date.
But there's a hitch. Library e-books don't work with two of the biggest e-readers, the Amazon Kindle and Apple's iPad. Analysts put Amazon's share of the e-book business as high as 90%, and giving away free downloads at the library would cut into that share.
We've had a lot of requests for the Amazon, does it work on the Kindle, and we would love for it to, but they don't allow anything but the books that they sell for their e-reader.
So that leaves the Kobo and the Nook and other less popular e-readers. As for Apple and Amazon, they're not in any hurry to jump on board with libraries. A library usually buys just one copy of an e-book, maybe two if it's a bestseller. Then thousands of people borrow that same copy.
It's real easy to lose control of your product.
That's Travis Bryant. He's director of digital products for Keen Communications, which publishes travel and business books. Digital piracy is a real concern among publishers. In one instance, Bryant's company found 700 illegal copies of a single book online. And Bryant says booksellers don't want to mess with a business model that works for them.
I think that's more the case with Amazon, Apple, is that we're succeeding on our own. If we introduce a third party, an open door, not so much the fear of losing control, but just introducing those variables would not be good to our business model.
Amazon confirmed that library books can't be downloaded onto the Kindle, but declined to be interviewed for this story. A spokesman for Apple said the only way library books would work on iPads and iPhones is through an app. Right now, there isn't one available. Still, many publishers, including Bryant, say having their books on as many virtual shelves as possible, including a library's, outweighs any potential risk.
It's portable, and that's the big thing. You're meeting the consumer where they are, and that's very appealing to publishers, bookstores, libraries.
For their part, libraries seem willing to work with booksellers. After all, the digital age is about immediacy. So if you're 27th on the waiting list for The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, the library plans to add a Buy It Now button. In Birmingham, I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
Coming up, those in need of some quick cash, step right this way.
We want to look at your income. We want to look at your expenses. We want to help you see why you're in this financial crisis.
Payday loans that won't make you go broke. But first, let's do the numbers. Minutes from the Federal Reserve's last meeting showing the central bank is ready and willing to pump more cash into the economy, help keep markets afloat today. The Dow Industrials gained 10 points, 0.1%, closed at 11,020. The NASDAQ gained 15 points, nearly 0.2%, ended at 2417. The S&P 500 notched up 4 points, about 0.3%, finished at 1169. Financials were higher. Bank of America fattened up 2.8% today. American Express chugged ahead 1.5%. Intel and Microsoft each gained around 1%. Adobe Systems and Dell padded up about 1.5% apiece. Apple gained 1% after Walmart said it's going to start carrying the iPad. But Google's announcement about a giant wind farm deal off the East Coast didn't really do much to put wind in its sails. Google gained about 0.5% today. The price on the 10-year T-note fell. The yield rose to 2.43%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by CSX, working to reduce traffic and pollution while moving 1 million tons of freight daily. CSX, how tomorrow moves. And by Vanguard, whose mission is to simplify investing and to help people reach their financial goals at vanguard.com/public radio. Every day, be sure to wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report. It's 8 minutes of radio you can't afford to miss. You'll hear updates on all the latest developments in business and finance as they happen.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. The International Energy Agency releases its monthly oil market report on supply and demand around the globe. Law enforcement officers from the U.S. and Europe discuss the death penalty at the National Press Club. And a happy birthday shout-out to the Navy. It all started on October 13th, 1775. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
Welcome back to Marketplace. From American Public Media, I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
I don't know what happened, but you were an unusually communicative bunch last week. Our story about New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg's new idea for food stamps was popular with many of you. He wants to limit the things people can buy with food stamps, specifically sugary drinks, Cokes and Pepsis and all that. This from Michael Chen of Cleveland Heights, Ohio, echoes what a lot of you said.
As a physician, I was so grateful for this news report. It's insanity that we should subsidize the foods and drinks that are directly affecting the decline of our health as a nation. I personally hope this experiment works.
New York Times economic columnist David Leonhardt was on the broadcast yesterday offering four ways to reduce the deficit. Cut Social Security, he said, cut Medicare, cut military spending, or raise taxes. David Rigby of North Carolina chose all of the above. Really, he writes, the answer is obvious. We have to do all four. We have been doing a lot of coverage of the foreign exchange markets the past week or so about how pretty much every country out there wants their currency to be just a little bit weaker to help boost exports and economic growth. Nicholas Carazzi from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, said our stories totally miss the point.
Until 1 hour of unskilled labor is worth the same in every country, we will all suffer the consequences of such artificial valuations controlled by the central banks.
On the topic of missing the point, my comments yesterday about texting while driving irked some of you, specifically this part. Here we go. All right, so this is a problem because by now I've wrecked my car. If I'm driving with this thing, I've wrapped it around a telephone pole. David Dartley wrote to say, who cares about your car? You've just as likely injured or killed an innocent person. New rule, he says. If you want to text while driving, Kai and everybody else, unbuckle your seatbelts first. All right, on now to other hazardous, although not necessarily fatal behavior, the Facebook like button. Our story on it last week reminded people that every time you click on it, you send your personal preferences directly to advertisers. Nifty, no? No, says Steve Tyler, a reformed one-time Facebook user from Berkeley, California.
I heard yet another reason why I'm glad I killed my Facebook account. The last thing I ever want to do is do a legitimate search on a topic only to have it skewed by what like it's I clicked. I predict a Flitter BookTube revolt within 5 years.
Just in case you missed it, that was a Flitter BookTube revolt within 5 years. Maybe. Who knows? But please tell us what you know. You can write to us through our website. It's marketplace.org. Click on that link in the top right-hand corner of the homepage. It's the one that says contact. Most of the financial sector has bounced back from the credit crisis just fine. The big Wall Street banks, as you know, are making billions of dollars again. Smaller regional and community lenders are doing all right as well. But there is one part of the industry that got through the whole mess with barely a scratch. Payday lending has become a $42 billion a year business in this country. The profits happen largely on the back of interest rates that easily rise into the triple digits. Borrowers get stuck in a cycle of more borrowing, taking out loans to pay off loans. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation has been looking into alternatives to see whether banks can make those small loans profitable without crazy interest rates. Marketplace's Elisa Roth visited one lower-cost lender in Wilmington, Delaware.
Downtown Wilmington is full of shiny glass buildings that house dozens of banks and credit card companies. But drive west into the city's poorer neighborhoods, and there's an entirely different kind of financial institution.
We've got Easy Cash with the dollar sign in place of the S. We've got 123 Cash, again, the dollar sign in place of the S. So it's two adjacent shopping centers, Easy Money AMG. I guess up the street we missed Deals on Wheels. Your job is your credit.
On this stretch, every strip mall has one, if not two, payday lenders. Barbara Reed thinks desperate borrowers should have a new place to stop. She runs the financial management program at a nonprofit community organization called West End Neighborhood House. A couple of years ago, she started noticing that a lot of people who came to her for help owed money to payday lenders. So she started looking for alternatives.
We wanted the same-day cash. We wanted the quick, easy turnaround. But we wanted something that was affordable, something that was safe.
In other words, a payday loan, just cheaper. Payday lenders typically charge at least $20 for every $100 borrowed. And annual interest rates can go as high as 500%. At West End, there's no upfront fee. The interest rate is capped at 15%, and borrowers have 3 months to pay back the loan, rather than the 2 weeks they get at most payday lenders. To do it, West End partnered with Wilmington Trust, which is a big traditional bank. The community group does all the paperwork and approves the loans. The bank is the actual lender. Wilmington Trust is one of about 30 banks across the country that took part in a two-year FDIC pilot program for small, affordable loans.
Okay, they got to put in their first and last name, address.
Doreen Conti, one of the people who helps issue loans at West End, is showing the forms applicants have to fill out. Just like at a payday lender, all a borrower needs is an ID, a bank statement to make sure they're not overdrawn, a pay stub, and a utility bill. But if payday lenders are strictly business, fast cash, no questions asked, West End wants to get personal. Applicants have to sit down with a counselor and go over their family budget. Here's Barbara Reed, the director of the program, again.
We want to look at your income. We want to look at your expenses. We want to help you see why you're in this financial crisis. What are some things you could do differently to prevent this financial crisis?
They sit down and they show it to you in black and white.
Marilyn Roman borrowed $500 from West End earlier this year. She says the budget counseling has helped her manage her money better.
Then you see where your money is going. And that's what a lot of us don't do. If we don't see it in black and white, it doesn't make sense.
Like a lot of clients, Roman had used a payday lender before she came to West End. One time, it cost her $600 to pay back a $400 loan. So far, West End has loaned out $300,000 to people like Roman. The default rate is less than 8%, which is high compared to regular banks, but which the FDIC says is roughly in line with default rates for unsecured personal loans and credit cards. Rayanne Miller works for the FDIC. She's convinced mainstream banks like Wilmington Trust can afford to offer alternatives to high-cost payday loans. They probably won't be terribly profitable, but banks can use them to build new relationships in the communities they serve.
We've been conducting meetings around the country to try and promote the product. So hopefully more institutions will see that it can be done in a reasonable manner and a profitable manner.
West End and Wilmington Trust are already replicating their program. Two other agencies now offer the loans, and West End is negotiating with two more. In Wilmington, Delaware, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. You can ask your financial advisor about Putnam 529 for America or visit putnam.com/529. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
These final notes today. First of all, Gap has dumped its new logo. In other news, did anybody out there know that Gap had a new logo? Apparently, the clothing chain swapped it out for a new one online a week or so ago without telling anybody. As happens in this internet age, though, somebody saw it, customers complained, the company caved, you know how it goes. Can't say as I blame them, though, the new one was just ugly. Also, vuvuzelas, what to do with the bajillions of noisemakers that provided the soundtrack for the World Cup down in South Africa this past summer. An agency there is running a contest, come up with alternative uses for them, you win $1,500. Send us your suggestions. We'll pass them along. Letters@marketplace.org is the email. But if your idea is a candlestick holder, a watering can, or a light fixture, don't bother. Those are already taken. Sorry. Anyway, that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow climbed 10 points. That is less than a tenth of 1%. The Nasdaq packed on 15 points, almost 2/3% there. The S&P 500 inched up 4 points, 1/3 of 1%. Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid with help from Doug Krisner and Sonata Lee, and that is where you can tune tomorrow for the latest in business and economic news. Tomorrow afternoon on this broadcast, ginormous retailers, think Walmart and Target, and how they're discovering that maybe smaller is better after all. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Do hope you can join us for that.
American Public Media.
all over the country.
We need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.